Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hey there, Johnny Ringo. How you doing?
Pretty good, Michael. How about you?
Yeah, fine. You feeling any better?
Yeah, the pain's really starting to kick in.
Hey, good evening, everyone. Welcome to another Tuesday night installment here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're discussing various IRS administrative remedies with our speaker, Mr. Tony Davis. My name is Martin Michaels. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. If you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com. If we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. If it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of what you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedom's Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, and you're just new to your remedies in the law, and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedom's Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. But we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law, anyway. Of course, when you call board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if we dispose properly and then answer properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, thank you, Martin, for sharing with us that wonderful disclaimer. It's kept me out of hock and jail for 30 years. It's a long dissertation there, what a good 13 minutes. But the point is that how can anyone accuse you of practicing law without a license if you try to scare them away during the disclaimer? So here we are tonight, folks, with our biweekly call with Johnny Ringo. And what we're learning tonight is the specifics now regarding his Title 18 investigations. He gave you the last couple of weeks. He's given you the 30,000-foot view, and then he started honing in on some things. So let's hear tonight how he brings some more information to us. Johnny?
Thank you, Michael. I would like to stress that this is information only and not advice. I'll give a little preview of what I gave last week, and then we'll get into the nitty-gritty of things. If a different bill passes the U.S. Senate or the House of Representatives, then the Senate, is the bill void and of no legal effect? First of all, until the Senate and the House pass the exact same bill, and the bill is signed by the President, or the bill is not signed and becomes law without signature because both houses pass the bill, there is no law. Just because the House of Representatives voted to pass a law does not make it an enforceable law without passage from the Senate as well. So all you had is a bill passed by the House in 1947 and a different one passed by the Senate in 1948. And then they have to get together and negotiate a combined or compromise law for passage of both houses before it becomes law or the law dies. Now, this is strictly federal. It has nothing to do with the state or any states. The Federal Criminal Code, Title 18, was enacted and codified in 1900. That statute has never been repealed. However, it cannot be used to imprison anyone because that would be a violation of the fair warning doctrine. A recodification of the criminal code was enacted by Congress in 1940. That statute was repealed in 1948 and is no longer law. Another recodification of Title 18, the criminal code, was presented as House Resolution H.R. 3190 in 1948. The House of Representatives voted on the bill on May 12, 1947. The vote was 38-6 to pass the bill. However, 435 members were in the House in 1948. A quorum, which is required, would have required 218 members. The quorum clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 5, Clause 1, was violated, and the bill was legally void at that time. Ignoring the quorum violation, the House sent H.R. 3190 to the Senate. The Senate amended the bill in the second session, and it was sent back to the House for approval. The House approved the amendments, but never voted on the entire bill. Congress adjourned, signed in the second session on June 20, 1948, and was dispersed and not in session. The Speaker of the House and President Pro Tem of the Senate signed the bill on June 22nd and 23rd, 1948, while Congress was not in session, which is a requirement. The bill signed was a bill amended and passed by the Senate, but not by the House. The President signed the bill amended and passed by the Senate, but never passed by the House on June 25, 1948 at 12:23 p.m. See the Presidential Library of President Truman Daily Calendar. To become a law, the President must sign a bill that is passed identically in both houses. Thus, the bill used to imprison American citizens, 1948, is not a law and constitutes fraud and obstruction of justice by any prosecutor and any federal judge which relies on it to take a citizen's rights away. Approximately 7.7 million, there's been a lot more than that as of late, have been placed in federal prison since 1948, all without a law. 18 U.S.C. states that no citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained without an act of Congress. Currently, there are 212,000 people are in federal prisons. Approximately 10% of the prisoners are citizens of other countries. The United States has approximately 3% of the world's population, but approximately 50% of the world's prisoners. In summary, no law has existed since 1948 to prosecute and imprison U.S. citizens. These are a few notes from the clerk of the U.S. House of Representatives. Personal correspondence of mine. After conducting a thorough examination of the journals, I found no entry in the journal of the House of any May 12, 1947 vote on H.R. 3190 bill. Although pages 343 to 344 of the journal of the House of Representatives from the first session of the 80th Congress indicates that the bill was amended, purportedly passed, and transmitted to the Senate for concurrence. The Senate took no action on H.R. 3190 bill prior to December 19, 1947. Signed in was adjoined. Pages 504S of the Congressional Record, 80th Congress, first session, 44 members voted, 38 to 6, to amend H.R. 3190 on May 12, 1947. Therefore, by counting the total yes and nays vote, a quorum was not present. According to the House rules, when less than a majority of a quorum votes to pass a bill, the journal must show the names of the members present but not voting. I found no such record of any names for the May 12, 1947 vote. I hope this information has heard your questions. Karen L. Haas, Clerk, U.S. House of Representatives. Another one, testimonial from the U.S. House of Representatives from Jeffrey Trudeau. Thank you for your letter requesting information on Title 18. In response to your inquiry, Congress was in session on June 1st, 3rd, 4th, 7 to 12, and 14 to 19, 1948. However, Title 18 was not voted on at this time. As you may know, Title 18 covers 845 pages in U.S. Code, and this wording was developed over many years. Signed copies of laws are archived at the National Archives and Records Administration and are not, I repeat, are not available to the public. I hope this has been some assistance to you. For future reference, most federal depository libraries possess this type of information if it is available. This is a letter from the U.S. House of Representatives, Office of the Clerk, signed by Jeffrey Trudeau. Here was a rather interesting information I come across. While July recognizing the court's authority to engage in judicial review, the executive branch has often urged courts to respect the legislative judgments of Congress. The Supreme Court has often acknowledged the apprentices of reliance on the political branches, policy choices, and judgment. The court accords great weight to decisions of Congress. In part, Congress is a colloquial branch of the government whose members take the same oath judges do to uphold the Constitution of the United States. These principles of defiance are fully applicable when Congress legislates in the commercial sphere. The courts according particular defenses when evaluating the appropriateness of the means. Congress has chosen to exercise its enumerated powers, including the Commerce Clause, to accomplish constitutional ends. Thus, all federal courts have been advised that all decisions concerning Title 18, 80-772, should be determined only by the acts of Congress, and that the jurisdiction of the courts will not and do not have jurisdiction over any previous or present Title 18 decisions. Now, we're going to go into a few affidavits here. This is from a judge who is a friend of mine and has researched it extensively. As a matter of fact, there were three judges and four lawyers that would pick up cases and review the legitimate accuracy of the cases. And this is his affidavit, sworn affidavit, about Title 18. The information contained in this document, Title 18 brief, has been thoroughly researched and has been completely documented. Verification has been performed through documents obtained from the clerk of the House of Representatives, the National Archives, and my own personal legal library of law books, which is quite extensive. My research has revealed that Public Law 80-772, Title 18, and any of its subsections do not exist in any shape or form. In fact, that Public Law 80-772 was never ratified by Congress and had never been entered as a legal statute. Any reference to this non-existent statute in any legal matter which would constitute fraud on the part of the prosecutor. If an individual is retained and prosecuted under these false statutes, it would constitute a clear case of obstruction of justice. The use of this non-existent statute is a grievous misrepresentation of justice and should be rectified immediately. This judge, this is as of June 2nd, 2017. The man graduated from Harvard Law School in 1957, ranked number one in his class. He worked for the Department of Justice from 1957 until 1980. He was appointed for a judge to the southeastern of my district in 1980 until 2001, and he was nominated to the Supreme Court in 2018. This man was a very intelligent individual, and I was proud to call him my friend. We've got an internal memorandum by a Mr. Harley G. Lapham to the department heads of the Bureau of Prisons on July 27th, 2009. I'll read the memorandum. Now, I do have documentation, affidavits from two individuals that happened to be in the prison at the time. But this document that I have is not certified. But they claim that it's exactly the one that he read to them. Here it is. Attention to all department heads. There has been a large volume of inmate requests for administrative remedies, questioning the validity of the Bureau's authority to hold or classify them under 18 U.S.C. 1948 on the claim that Public Law 80-772 was never passed or signed in the presence of a quorum or a majority of both houses of Congress, as required by Article 1, Section 5, Clause 1 of the Constitution. Although most courts have thus far relied on Field versus Clark, 143 U.S. 640, 1892, to avoid a ruling on the merits of these claims. However, there has been some which has stated that they were not bound by the Field Clause, but those cases did not involve any quorum. Clause challenge. So out of an abundance of caution, I contacted the Office of Legal Counsel, the National Archives, and the Clerk of the House of Representatives that there is no record of any quorum being present during the May 12, 1947 vote on H.R. 3190 bill in the House. See Section 92, Congressional Record 5048. And the record is not clear as to whether there was any Senate vote on the H.R. 3190 bill during any session of the 80th Congress. There is only one Supreme Court case that says in order for any bill to be valid, the journals of both houses must show that it was passed in the presence of a quorum. See United States versus Ballin, Joseph and Company. 144 U.S. 13 was passed in the presence of a quorum. 1892. The clerk of the House states that the May 12, 1947 vote was a voice vote, but the parliamentation of the House states that the voice vote is only valid that when the journal show that a quorum is present and that it is unlawful for the Speaker of the House to sign any enrolled bill in the absence of a quorum. On May 12, 1947, a presence of 218 members in the Hall of the House was required to be entered in the journal in order for the 44-member 38-6 vote to be legal. It appears that the 1909 version of the Federal Criminal Code has never been repealed. Therefore, although adjudication of the constitutionally of congressional enactments has generally been thought to be beyond the jurisdiction of federal administration and agencies, this rule is not mandatory, according to the Supreme Court in the case of Thunder Basin Cole versus Reich, 510 U.S. 200, 215, 1894. Therefore, the Bureau, under the advice of legal counsel, feels that it is in the best interest of public safety, not of the inmates, of public safety, to continue addressing all of these administration remedy requests by stating that only the Congress or courts can repeal or declare a federal statute unconstitutional. And here's a little kicker. After this memorandum was presented to a majority of the inmates in Yazoo Prison, it should be noted that Harry Lapham requested an investigation by the DOG 2008 and 2010. And the DOJ did the research and provided no law exists. Lapham exercised his discretion to keep people in prison for the public good. Once the Lapham memorandum was leaked, Lapham was arrested for drunk driving down the wrong side of the road in Washington, D.C. The DOJ then got him a job as the head of a correction of the Corrections Corporation of America at a salary of $1.6 million per year. And here's another little kicker. Ironically, Section 400 of Title 18 states, A, no citizen shall be imprisoned or otherwise detained by the United States except pursuant to the Act of Congress. Curiously, the same volume, two pages before the one at right, was stated that Title 18 was enacted into positive law by an Act of Congress on June 25, 1948. However, House Clerk of Justice wrote in a letter to Charles Deegan, dated 28, 2000, that Congress was not in session on June 25, 1948. The session ended June 19, 1948. So, to wrap it up, Title 18 is of great, immense question. I've testified in 73 federal cases as to the status of Title 18. I do not know the outcomes of the most of them because they were out of state. I gave my testimony and I left the courtroom, and I never really bothered to file or file the results of the cases, because the federal system has got about a 99% conviction record. They do not take anything into consideration on testimony. And I've experienced a little setback lately in the local federal court, where I was requested by the defense to give the information to the court on Title 18, of which this individual was being prosecuted under. After about 10 minutes of my report, the judge called, slammed his gavel down, and says, "Everybody in my chambers." I went back and they sat down, and the judge directly looked at me. Now, the prosecuting attorney was there, the defense attorney, which was a public defender, and a federal marshal. And the judge looked at me and he says, "I've heard your spiel at least 3 times already, and I'm sick of it." He says, "This man that's on trial is guilty." Now, granted, we're less than a day into this trial, and the judge has already convicted this individual without hearing the complete testimony. I was very, very frustrated. I looked at him, and there was a few words exchanged between us, because I do not hold anything back. And I got up and I left. But the trial was still in session a day later. So I do not like to get my butt kicked. So I went and I printed up 13 copies of this Title 18 and exactly what it covered. And when the court was adjourned, these jurors went to a local restaurant for a lunch break. I asked the receptionist or the waitress where they would be seated, and she told me. So I set 13 copies down on each chair, and I requested that they be left there after they were read. I got 10 copies back. I was really surprised. And then on the following day, I employed the use of a few of my motorcycle associates, of which they are number three on the FBI's most watched list. And we visited the courtroom. We walked in. And we sat down, and when the magistrate looked, and he says, "I'm the judge, and this is my courtroom." And I stood up, and he says, "I want you removed from the courtroom." I says, "Well, first of all, the federal government only rents this land." I says, "This is a state building." I said, "And you are not a judge. You're a magistrate." I said, "There is a big difference." And I thought he was going to blow a gasket right there, but he didn't. So I just sat down, and we followed the proceedings, and the judge looked at the clerk, or at the bailiff, and he says, "I would like to have these individuals removed." And the bailiff looked at him and just shook his head, because most of them were sleeping from the party I had provided for them the night before anyways. But then he requested U.S. Marshals to remove the leather-clad individuals, and they just looked at him like he was crazy. And then they looked down on the floor. And the judge was very, very irate. So after about a half hour of testimony, I got up and left with my associates. And when the verdict came down, which I am very, very proud of, the verdict came down not guilty. And I thought, well, it's a small victory. I did not know this individual at all. But on the outside of the courthouse, he came up and he shook my hand and he says, I want to thank you for all you've done. I says, well, I says, the public defender will get the bill. And she came up to me and she says, I suppose your fees are going to be increased. I says, they will be when you get the bill. But that was a small victory for me. It was one of the few cases that I was able to testify and have any influence in the federal system that we were victorious. It took a while, but when I was laying in bed Monday night, I was thinking about on how the federal government bullies everybody. And I'm an honorary member of the Seven Tribe Nation in my state. And I thought about how bad the natives of this country had been treated. And then I thought of good old Mr. Custer and how he tried bullying his way through, and where it got him. And I imagine right before he stuck the gun to his head and blew his brains out, his last words were, where in the hell did all these blanking Indians come from? And I thought, okay. And then I come up with the realist idea of the majority rules, or they can have an influence. And it worked out fairly well for me because I am not a pacifist. I do not believe in turning the other cheek because you might lose a few teeth. And I need all the teeth I can get. So this was a small victory for me, and I'm rather proud of it. And I come up with another little bit of information of which people can use. I've questioned several attorneys if they have ever issued what they call a quo warranto. The spelling is Q-U-O, new word, W-A-R-R-E-N-T-O. And what it is a request given to the judge or the magistrate and the prosecuting attorney to prove that they have authority to sit on their high horse and prosecute or judge an individual. And a judge, now this applies to both state and federal. It's the canons of office, the credentials of a judge. For a judge, there is four credentials required, and you've got to furnish it upon request. It's a proper presidential credential, a proper OPI form 64, a proper oath of office, 28 U.S.C. 2854, and proper Senate confirmation, both from the state and the feds. The state needs state confirmation from the Senate, and the federals need from the Senate confirmation. The administrative court or the prosecutor has got to have on file with the clerk of courts an appointment of the affidavit, 5 U.S.C. 331, an oath of office, 28 U.S.C. 544, an appointment letter delegating the power to prosecute. And I have found that approximately 91% of the magistrates, or what people would call a judge, do not have any of this on file or have filled any of these forms out. And 85% of the prosecution or district attorneys do not have anything on file. And there is a form that is to be presented to the judge who is on handling the trial and to the prosecuting attorney that they've got to furnish this paperwork to the person on trial. And they've got 20 days to do all this. They've got within 20 days of all original documents required to prove his or her authority to hold office as a government official during the referred proceedings. As I state, the vast majority of judges and the vast majority of prosecuting attorneys do not have any of this on file. So, according to law, they cannot prosecute. But they still go ahead and do it. I have questioned many, many attorneys, a vast majority of them, as to this quo warranto being executed. And to my surprise, only one out of over 200 ever heard of this quo warranto. They looked at me like, what the hell are you talking about? And when I furnished it to them and showed it to them, they were dumbfounded. In law school, they never had heard anything of it. So, it's just food for thought. And that's about all I've got for now. I have a little interesting story that a friend of mine's daughter was going to Northwestern, and I presented this Title 18 to her, and I asked her, have you ever been received any courses that questions the validity of any law? And she looked at me and she says, why should we? She says, it's law. It's passed. I says, you do not question it? She says, absolutely not. So she went back to Northwestern, and the dean of the law school over there gave me a call because they had two summer school classes. One of, I believe, 17 students, and the other one of 18 or 19, and two law professors. And I presented this question to her, and she says, that's something very interesting. So she presented it to the law professors. They spent 9 weeks researching Title 18, and they came up and says, it does not exist legally. I says, okay. And then the dean also called me up, and she says, you know, this is very interesting. She says, we've never had a class that would question any legal statute, if it's a legal statute at all. I says, well, it's something to think about. Anyways, she got back to me about 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, and she says, I presented it to the educational board, and they agreed to have it. But a week later, it was shot down. And I said, well, why? She says, because we received federal funding, and they did not feel it was appropriate to question. So that's my little story for today, and that's the conclusion. And I thank Michael for the airtime.
I was just I just had to chuckle on that one. Anyways, yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, you know the routine. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2. Hello, Kent. We'll be with you in 1 second. And for those of you on Freedom's Radio, look to the center right of your monitor. You'll notice a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. Left-click inside of it. Type away your comment or question. Underneath that silhouette of a rectangle, you'll see a place to put your name and some other information if you care to. Then hit submit, and I'll be happy to give voice to your comment or your question. So with that having been said, we'll start with Kent, go to Anita, and I'll be checking some others in a moment. Go ahead, Kent.
Okay, good evening, gentlemen. Thank you for your presentation, Johnny. I appreciate it, and you should be proud of what you accomplished with those jurors in that particular case. What I wanted to ask you was, on the quo warranto, since they had, you mentioned, I think if I understood you correctly, that they have 20 days to furnish that paperwork. Is it possible that once you would bring that to their attention, that they would somehow get that paperwork done, even though part of it involved getting a Senate confirmation, et cetera? Have you ever seen that happen, or do you think that that would be logical for them to do that?
First of all, no, it would not be logical, because they've got to have this paperwork within 10 days of the day they take office.
Okay.
They take office, they've got to have this paperwork on file within 10 days. And nothing can be postdated. So
okay.
They might try it, and if they can have collusion with the clerk of courts, they might get away with it. But I seriously doubt it.
Okay. So, in other words, they'd have to have an orchestrated effort involving several different people colluding with one another in order to get this somehow backdated.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. Again, thank you very much. I appreciate your answer.
You're welcome.
All right. Excellent. Next is Anita. Go ahead, Anita.
Yes. This may be a really dumb question. I'm trying to, you know, follow all this. I don't know much about the law. From what I'm understanding, this Title 18 only has to do with federal crimes, whatever they are, I don't even know what they are, it wouldn't apply to someone being convicted of a murder, just, you know, everyday murder that didn't shoot a congressman or something?
First of all, there's no dumb question.
Okay.
There's dumb answers, but there's not a dumb question.
I agree there. In Title 18, there's 5,037 statutes listed. I do not know if there are several statutes or titles in the federal law. I do not know. I do not believe Title 18 is mainly for drug convictions. Child pornography, and a multitude of others. I cannot answer it. I do not know if murder would be under Title 18. It would be on the documents that they're charging the individual with. But I cannot answer that question, what murder would be charged under.
Okay.
My main concern has been mainly the drug enforcement.
Okay. All right. It's got me interested because this friend of mine who doesn't seem to be able to ever get out of prison, it was a whole bunch of corrupt things that happened. And I at one time saw all the documents, you know, through emails and stuff, but that's been a long time, so I don't know what's.
I'd be curious. It would be stated on those documents under what title he was charged under.
It would be or it wouldn't be?
It would be. It has to be.
Okay. I'll write him a letter. He would know. Yeah, but probably not. But anyway, I'll find out.
Like I say, I don't know what it would be because my main concern has been the drug cases. There's been a multitude of probably, I would say, 95% of the cases that I've been requested to testify in has been mainly drug cases.
Okay. And you don't know how they've turned out? Is that what you said? You didn't follow all of them?
Well, I live in a Midwestern state, and most of the cases I was hired by the different law firms were in the eastern part of the country or the southern part. And I would give my testimony, and I would leave. And I really did not follow how the cases turned out. Like I say, 99% of the federal cases, it doesn't matter what you do, you're still guilty. And so my testimony would come up in usually the third or fourth day of the trial, and I would give my testimony, and I'd wrap it up, and I would leave. And I really didn't follow the rest of the trial because I was on my way home. They only paid me for so many days.
So what you're saying is anyone who's charged in a drug case doesn't have a hope in hell of getting off from the prison sentence.
Well, there is a bill. Now, this does not contain all drugs. It's strictly marijuana. There was a bill that passed the House of Representatives and is presently supposed to be voted on in the Senate, which would legalize marijuana within the federal system. Now, that does not, it's only marijuana. It's not any other cases. But
right.
If we win that one, we got our foot in the door. Because
yeah.
In 1933, with the repeal of prohibition, there was a statement at the end of that bill that states that all federal laws have got to be in sequence. And if they would repeal Title 18 or repeal that marijuana statute out of Title 18, that would really mess things up. We've got about 6 weeks to see if anything materializes out of that at the present time.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Miss Anita. Next, somebody raise your hand, press star 2 on your keypad. Otherwise, we're going to have an early night tonight. Press star 2, and I will go there. We have a first-time caller. If you wouldn't mind terribly, Jennifer will be right with you. This is someone ending a phone number ending in 7278. Would you mind sharing just your first name only, please?
Guy.
7270. Guy?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Welcome to the call, Guy. How did you hear about us?
A friend of mine. Was telling me about total asset protection, and I'll be interested in starting to research all these documents. And you know, honestly, I can only hope that what I am hearing from you all is 100% correct. I'm curious to know that in order to change my status, what is it? Who is it that I need to call? in order to do this?
That would be me. Let me give you a introductory number, phone number to reach out to me. In fact, I'll do this. I'll just put your number here on a board, and okay. I'll give you a call. What state are you in, sir?
Right now I'm in the state of Montana, but the number is out of New York.
I got it. No, I got it. I don't need your number. I got it on my caller ID here. I don't want you to publicize it. What I'll do is since you're, are you Central or Mountain Time?
Mountain Time.
All right. I'll just give you a shout right after this call, which is going to be not too much longer, another 20 minutes or so. All right?
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much, guy.
My pleasure. All right. Jennifer, go ahead. What's your question? Besides, am I going to give those recordings over to you?
I was taught that Title 18 was what we were going to use to go after the county clerks and everything who wouldn't file for record deeds and everything. But if it's not real, can you still use it? And do they?
Absolutely. If they want to make believe it's real, then we're going to use it against them. Absolutely.
Okay. And does John use that to do the same thing? PJ.
Yes.
Okay.
In fact, when PJ was talking about its application, he was actually referring to John's use of it as well.
Okay. And, yeah, I guess Anita and I would like another call with Pete John whenever he's available. Thanks.
All righty, we'll handle that. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you all for joining us this evening and remind you, please, that tomorrow night we will have Mr. Slevin here who will show you how you can, as an employee, operate through an LLC, and Mr. Slevin and his team will contact your employer and assist you in translating from being an employee to being a worker for the LLC that you'll be creating. Very, very unique twist, and it's been working for nearly 20 years that he's been doing this. Also, if you are an entrepreneur or business owner, he can show you how to modify or redo an LLC for yourself. In both instances, these LLCs are not, I repeat, are not taxed. So it's going to be a great call for that tomorrow night. Encourage you to be there. I think I've said enough. So thank you for joining us tonight. Johnny Ringo, that was a great call. And just to show you how tough this guy is, he got shot earlier today. You want to tell us about that real quick?
Well, I'm in my state here, I've got a 640-acre compound, and it's a sovereign property because it was issued to my great-great-great-grandfather from the Spanish government. So this is my little abode here. And I was going out to get the mail, and a black Yukon vehicle drove past, and they opened up a fire on me. And I happened to stop one in the leg. And it hurt like hell, so I got home, and I got the slug out. And then it was bleeding pretty good, and then a couple of my buddies, they hauled me to the doctor, and they got the bleeding stopped and stitched up. And I got to say, it hurts like hell, but I was shot three different times in Nam, so it kind of reminded me of old days. But like I said, the authorities are not too kindly to my operations.
The when I hear somebody talk about a black Yukon or a black Cadillac, a black whatever, those big massive SUVs, I always think of government cars. Did it look like a government car to you?
I'm a later call. I'll kind of fill you in on the particulars.
Okay. All righty. Enough said. Thank you all for joining us this evening. I hope that we see you again tomorrow night. Until then, good night, everyone, and be absolutely well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.